The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we are going to answer several listener emails and talk about a variety of retirement and IRA topics that Jim has not shared with me. But that's what makes the show exciting for me, is it's new and fresh,
and you have no idea
anything
could
come at
about.
Me from around the corner. So welcome to today's show. This is a live recorded show, so we cannot take calls today. But in the not-too-distant future, I think we're going to be taking some calls, and we're actually discussing the possibility of live-streaming all of our shows, or practically all of them, which would give people the ability to call in from anywhere, not just Northern Colorado area, and ask questions live on these shows. So it's going to take us a little bit of a technology upgrade and working out a couple other things, but I'm thinking that's coming on the horizon. Do you agree, Jim?
We are toying with the idea. Chris hit me the other day with being able to, as we do fewer and fewer live shows on KFKA, our local Northern Colorado radio station, would it be possible to do live shows for our iTunian listeners instead of them having to send us email questions that sometimes languish for a little while before I can get to them? Arrange it where they can call the office during a certain part of the week while we're recording, and we can put them on live in the sense it's not a live podcast. We will be recording live, and that podcast will be available later for replay. But while we're recording that podcast, actually broadcast the recording session live as we're recording and allow people to call during that time period, and we would answer their questions. And then, of course, we would take that recording. That recording then has to go to, you see, let me explain. The regulators will consider that a live appearance. If we use Facebook Live, which is some sort of weird thing Facebook has that lets you broadcast things live, or any of the other programs that offer that ability, the regulators will consider that a literal live appearance between Chris and I. It is totally unscripted. If anyone listens to our show, period, it's never scripted. But it would be totally unscripted in the sense we don't know who's going to call. We don't know what they're going to ask. That is perfectly fine to broadcast live while it's happening. So we could do that, and we would record it at the same time. But in order to make that recording available for playback at any time, in other words, at any time someone wants to hear it, they can go hear it. That's the difference. As soon as that becomes recorded and made available for playback, the regulators consider that, Chris, no longer a live appearance. They consider that an advertisement. And then advertisements have to be approved by compliance officials to make sure we're not saying anything we shouldn't. So I guess the regulators feel we can pretty much say things we shouldn't as long as it's live.
True.
But the minute it's recorded and made available for people to hear when they want, they think it crosses that line from a live appearance to an advertisement. Mm-hmm. And then they want to be a little bit more cautious on what is played.
And that's, technically that would, sorry to interrupt, but that would give us the ability for to answer questions on the show on topics that we're technically not allowed to discuss. Well, we're allowed. It's just that they make some hurdles that are so high to get over to allow them to be recorded and played back. As long as it was live, a live question, people could ask us things that we don't normally discuss. And I'd like to tell you what those things are, but I think if I mention them, then we'll also get in trouble for mentioning them and not getting the proper approval. So
like
the good news is
like
there's some...
George Collins' seven dirty words.
Right.
The regulators have certain things they don't want us talking about. But to borrow from that compliance who's listening to this, what Chris is meaning to say is during the recording of this new approach he has of letting our iTunians call us during our recording session... If someone did call us during the recording of that recording session, that live appearance, Chris, and we answered something that the regulators don't really want us talking about, that will not be allowed to be played on the recording.
Correct. We'd have to take all that out.
It would be fine on the Facebook live broadcast of the recording of our podcast, but it would not be available on our podcast because the minute it's recorded and made available for playback at any time, it is now an advertisement.
Right.
So it's just kind of one of those weird rules people. And people sometimes ask us, why doesn't Dave Ramsey have to worry about that? Why doesn't Clark Howard and
Susie Orman
have to worry about that? Easy. They are not licensed financial planners. Case closed. They're not. They have no, in my opinion, right to be giving financial advice. And because they're not giving financial advice for compensation, I do own a financial planning practice and people do pay me for my advice. So because people pay me directly for my advice, I have to register as a financial advisor or investment advisor or both. And I have to operate under certain rules that what we call financial entertainers do not.
Mm-hmm. And not to say that any of them, not to specify any one of them, that any of them don't have some valid advice and that sort of thing. Sometimes every one of them have uttered things that I wanted to keel over with shock.
Well, borrowing on that, we are going to talk about a Dave Ramsey show that I listened to about a month ago now on the way home once when I was working late. And I don't regularly listen to Dave Ramsey. He just happened to be on the radio as I was flipping through the stations. Mm-hmm. We actually captured that. We went back to his website and captured that portion of the show. Pete listened to it. He was cringing on the advice, and he even said the same thing. We got to dedicate a show and answer this question the way it should have been answered. Mm-hmm. Because the answer Mr. Ramsey provided was, if I said it was bad, that would be giving it a compliment.
Yeah.
It was horrendous.
Of all the good things he says on certain topics, I will tell you, I will admit honestly that I have on more than one occasion almost gotten into a car accident hearing something he said, that it was so distracting because it was so poor, the advice, that I almost got into an accident. So unfortunately, it taints all the other good stuff that he says, but everyone will have to kind of judge that themselves. I'm certainly not going to. He's very successful. I admire a lot of what he's done, but over the years, he's kind of started to tiptoe into some areas where he clearly has no expertise. He started out fairly narrow in his approach and was quite an expert on a fairly narrow area in financial planning and financial advice. But he's kind of broadened himself as far as what he speaks about, but hasn't broadened his education. So keep some of the, you know, keep that in mind. I wouldn't go out and act directly upon anything he says. And he has a disclaimer at the end of the show that says, don't do it. Don't follow any of my advice without checking with someone. And they list all kinds of things.
But we say the same thing, I think, in our disclosure. I think the regulators make us put that in there.
We do, because on a format like this, we can't possibly know everything about your whole situation. So when we make generalized comments, there might be something unique about you personally that we don't discover in this short format back and forth, maybe with an email or a phone call, that you should trust that advice fully and act upon it without verifying with either us or someone else who will learn your entire situation and story and make sure that is the proper advice to be following. I think, you know, a lot of what we talk about, and Susie Orman and Dave Ramsey and those folks, not that I'm necessarily, you know, putting us on that same
They're far more successful than us, but success does not mean they're giving good advice. And that's the issue. And the other thing, again, if you talk to anybody in our industry, Chris, it's not that we don't like them. I'm not jealous over his success, although I'd love to have it. I just cringe at some of the advice and the advice that made me, Mr. Calm, right? I was just beside myself. Mm-hmm. That's why I got a hold of you the next day. I didn't even know you could hear old shows on his website. And then it was either you or Justin sent me the link, and I listened to it again. And then I told Pete, listen to this. And he was, oh my God. Yeah. And it just was bad advice. Terrible, terrible advice. And we will be talking about that show. It was to a South Carolinian Linian listener he had, a caller. But hopefully someone in South Carolina will be able to find this actual caller and give him what I feel is going to be far better advice than what Mr. Ramsey gave. But that said, I will give kudos to Mr. Ramsey. He has helped a lot of people. Hopefully he has helped more people than he has hurt. But it's important people understand Chris and I have certain rules we have to follow because we are actually real financial planners. We are not entertainers who just have knowledge in the financial world providing advice to callers and not being paid and compensated for it. Now, no callers to this show have ever paid us, but I do have a business where people do pay me to provide financial planning advice. So I am held to a far, far, far higher standard than these financial educators. They often say things that we just plain old can't. The regulators won't let us. And that's sometimes, if you're ever wondering, my God, Jim and Chris never talk about this, that, the other thing. Chances are it's because the regulators are telling us we can't, because we actually are real financial planners, not financial entertainers. And there is a huge difference. And the financial entertainers can say an awful lot and get away with it, because they don't hold themselves out as being real financial planners. It's kind of like someone saying, hey, I know a lot about healthcare, so I'm going to answer your health-related questions, but I'm not a doctor.
Right.
And that's pretty much what they are. They're not doctors, but they're providing health-related advice.
Which, again, doesn't mean all their advice is bad.
Nope.
But you have to realize what the source is. And bottom line, anything you hear on this radio show, and also on anyone else's radio show, you should, before acting directly upon it, you should take it upon yourself to educate yourself so that you feel comfortable that that advice is proper for you individually. And that could be interacting with us to clarify it. That might work fine. Could be talking to somebody else. If you get another opinion, you might want to reach back to us, find out why there's a difference there.
Listeners can actually hire us. There's
that too.
We don't talk about that enough. We sometimes can't get very deep, especially with an email, Chris. Even when I send an email out and ask you for more clarification, it's a lot different than a coffee and a second opinion phone call. Or if you're in Northern Colorado, when you come into our office for a coffee and a second opinion, we can delve into a lot deeper topics. We can ask questions. We can get live answers right there. And we can direct the question. And hopefully answer it a little better. So we always want our iTunians to know. And we know you're a feisty little bunch. And most of you are do-it-yourselfers. I mean, why else on God's good earth would you be listening to a financial podcast? But we are available. Nothing wrong with a second opinion. That's why I call it a coffee and a second opinion. You're going to sit there, you're going to grab a cup of coffee, you're going to put me on speakerphone, and you're going to chat away with me and get a second opinion of what it is you're doing. And then, yes, some people do hire us. I'll admit that. Some people don't. But if you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't fear calling a true planner. We have said this before. I think last week we answered it was a short question, but we spent the entire show. The gentleman who was trying to decide if the asset management fee he was paying was worth it or not. Remember mm-hmm. that one?
Yes.
And we were trying to get him to understand because he did. I wrote to him and he disclosed that not only does that 1% of his assets, he had $1.4 million. He was paying 1% a year to have it managed or $14,000 a year. He wanted to know if we thought that was worth it. Well, I asked him, are you getting financial planning as well for that advice or just investment management? He said, I get financial planning as well. And that's where I have a hard time saying if it was worth it or not, because I don't know the advice that's being given. And you used the second best analogy on this radio show ever. You used the analogy of the cell phone plan,
mm-hmm.
with the best analogy being the zebra on the Serengeti that I came up with for what? Income annuities.
What?
Oh, don't play dumb. You told me you liked that analogy. You actually gave me a compliment.
We'll have to revisit that on another day. I don't remember that one.
You don't remember
I don't remember the details of
it. You don't remember the best analogy ever given on the retirement?
The best one?
No, the best one was mine. Your second best mm-hmm. one was the cell phone. All right, next segment we're going to...
Okay.
You describe your analogy. I'm going to describe mine.
Great.
And I will vote on which one is the best.
Okay.
Impartially.
Perfect.
But what I was trying to say before Chris distracted me, when that gentleman sent us that email, once he told me that financial planning was rolled into that management fee, it becomes very difficult to say if he's overpaying for the management fee without knowing how much was for the management fee and how much was for financial planning. It's very important to understand, listeners, especially the do-it-yourselfers. Do not be afraid. I get it. If you're managing your own assets and you're worried if you're going to a quote-unquote financial planner or financial advisor, he or she is just going to try to manage your money or sell you something, try to seek out an advisor who actually charges for each individual element and will charge a flat fee or a retainer or an hourly fee, but has fully disclosed it like we do here. You can hire us for an hour of our time. You can hire us for a project. You can hire us on an ongoing basis. You don't have to have us manage your money. We don't need to. There's plenty of services we offer as retirement planners. So you got to kind of look for that and don't be afraid to get a second opinion. But in that same vein, I don't know how we got on this topic, but I'm going to run with this rabbit. On the same vein, make sure you ask your advisor, what have you done to warrant sitting there to be able to give me this advice? It's not like a doctor where you go into my doctor's office. He went to the Air Force Academy. That's where he got his education. He has his Air Force Academy stuff on the wall. He has the thing from his medical school, the diploma thing. He's got pictures of him. He played on the Air Force football team. He's got a picture of him in a jet and where he went for his medical. And he's got all that on his wall, so you know what he did. You know you teach this, Chris. What do you need to do to be a financial planner?
To be just a plain old financial planner, you just have to tell people, I'm a financial planner.
Oh, please. There's got to be more than that.
Maybe print some business cards.
Oh, well, that's hard.
Yeah. $9.95 on the internet. That's about it. Unfortunately, people can just use that name. They can use that word without any kind of requirements, any sort of education. It's just, I'm here.
And you
I
can
am.
Have a radio show. As right. long as you don't hold yourself out and charge for your financial advice. So the radio show people, they make money how? They sell advertising
mm-hmm.
on their shows.
Or stuff. They advertise stuff that they sell themselves,
correct.
Like books and tapes and right. seminars and all that kind of stuff.
And that is, the regulators let that fly. I have said repeatedly in the state of Colorado, in order to take $50 from someone and cut their hair as a barber or a cosmetologist, you have to go to 1,500 hours of study. You have to go to a trade school. They got these little schools you go to. 1,500 hours of study. You have to pass two practical exams administered by your peers. And you have to be then licensed by the state in order to take $50 from someone to cut their hair. And the worst case scenario is you screw up on the hair, especially with mine. It's so short and Chrissy doesn't really have much. You screw up on either one of our haircuts. What do we got to wait? 3 weeks and we're all back to normal?
Mm-hmm.
But to take $500,000 from someone and invest it, you just got to call yourself a financial planner.
Doesn't seem fair.
It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely ridiculous. You screw up and lose someone's $500,000, that person's not retiring. The regulators just have this bass ackwards. It's frustrating. Now, if you actually want to print a business card, like Chris said, and say you are a financial planner or an investment advisor, and you want to be regulated under the Investment Advisory Act of 1940, in other words, you don't want to be a broker, but you just want to be an investment advisor, or what the industry calls an investment advisor representative, an IAR, then you do have to pass what is called the Series 65 exam. So let's now talk about this. To cut someone's hair, you have to go to 1,500 hours of study, pass two practical exams administered by your peers. You know what a practical exam is? That's hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually going to be given a real-life person. You got to cut their hair.
Mm-hmm.
Two practical exams administered by your peers and then register in the state. Here's what you do to pass the Series 65 exam. Once you pass the Series 65 exam, and this will probably come as a shock to people, financial planners, a true planner, are actually regulated under a law written in 1940, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. There is no, let me repeat this, there is no law that specifically addresses, Chris, financial planning. Not investment advisory, financial planning. What we do when we sit there and help people get a whole overview, Chris, of their retirement, help them determine what is the taxation going to be now and in the future? What is their Social Security going to be? Should they start doing Roth conversions now or later? Can they benefit from an income plan? Will their assets last long enough? How to take Medicare? Will they qualify for Medicaid? All these types of analysis that we do, that's financial planning. Notice I didn't mention investment advising. But to be a financial planner, to give that detailed level advice, you are regulated under a law from 1940 that regulated investment advisors. And that's advisors spelled with an ER. They use the ER in that law. Sometimes people say to me, what's the difference between an advisor and an advisor? OR and ER. There's really no technical difference. But if you are going to be an investment advisor regulated under the 1940 Act, you use ER, not the OR. Because the law that addresses investment advisors specifically spells it ER. Well, they had to find, they being the regulators, had to find a place to put, Chris, financial planners. So they threw us under the Investment Advisors Act with an ER of 1940. That's why it's so muddied. You see these people calling themselves financial planners, but really all what they're doing is buying portfolios for people. Because they are regulated under the 1940 law. Well, that 1940 law says in order to give investment advice, you have to pass a test that the regulators administer. And they call it the Series 65. And that test, Chris, is just 135 questions. 80% of those questions are not on your understanding of financial planning or even investment advising. You know what they're on?
The law and regulations.
Exactly. 80% of the questions are on the law you have to follow. It's insane. I'll talk more about this when we come back, just so you kind of understand what the hell my industry is all about.
Well, on that uplifting note, the music means we're at our first break, and after we come back from this break, we're going to hear one of the top songs from 1935. The title of this song is an axiom that has been popularly used by the American Navy since the War of 1812.
The Navy?
Apparently.
What's an axiom?
Well, you'll see. I'll give it away if I tell you.
I just keep thinking of that in the Navy.
That's a little later. That's the 1970s. But we'll go back to 1812. So we'll find out what this is after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Shipmates, stand together, don't give up the ship. Fair or stormy weather, we won't give up, we won't give up the ship. Friends and pals forever, it's a long, long trip.
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is one of the top songs from 1935, from the 1935 musical Shipmates Forever, starring Dick Powell, who was actually performing that song right there. So Dick was reporting, performing Don't Give Up the Ship. And that phrase, Don't Give Up the Ship, used by the American Navy since the War of 1812. Where that tie-in comes from, and song was popular throughout the mid-30s and played by lots of other bands, including Tommy Dorsey and all the others that you remember from 1935 to 1940. Well, those of you who were alive at that point. So, back to the Retirement and IRA Show. We were just spontaneously, I guess, on a bit of a rant about...
Tangent. Well, you got me going.
I had no intention of talking about all this.
I don't know how we got on to spend much more time on this.
But
I want our listeners to know, when you talk with a financial planner, don't be afraid to ask him or her, what gives you the right to sit here before me? And you need to understand a financial planner will be regulated under the 1940 Act, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, with advisor spelled with an E-R. And in order to be an investment advisor representative, which is what the regulators call investment advisors, in order to be an investment advisor representative, you have to pass a test called the Series 65. The Series 65 has 135 questions on it. Takes about 4 hours to do if you're average. You can't go longer, but you could finish it a hell of a lot faster. I did on mine. And about 80% of the questions cover, and that percentage might be off a little bit, but about 80% of the questions cover, Chris, not your aptitude of being a financial planner.
Or giving investment advice.
It covers, exactly, it doesn't even cover investment advice. It covers what is in the 1940 Act, the rules and regulations you have to follow. What's an advertisement? What isn't an advertisement? What has to go in your ADV Part 1? What goes in your ADV Part 2? How often do your clients get that form ADV? When does it have to be changed? Yes, is these important things? Sure, I guess it is. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd put him at about a 0.3 in importance to actually giving financial planning or investment advice. They're meaningless on that. The rest of the questions will measure some of your aptitude. What is an IRA? What is a Roth? Silly little questions like that. Mm-hmm. When you pass that exam, and to pass the Series 65, you could either go nowadays with the internet. You can attend seminars right online whenever you want, on-demand seminars, and listen. You can buy books and seminars. If you study, it would probably take you, I would say, 4 to 8 hours on average to study for the Series 65 exam. Nothing that difficult, if that. And once you pass, folks, you're done. Forever. There is no requirements to get continuing education, to retest, to do anything. That's it. Now you can go out, hang up a shingle, and be not only an investment advisor, but a financial planner. Now, most investment advisor representatives will work for another registered investment advisory firm called an RIA. That's why they become an investment advisor representative. If you want to start your own, you can just start your own RIA on your own. And if you have the CFP designation, as well as the CFA designation, the PFS designation, and a few others, you don't even have to take the Series 65. And I support that. I'm not trying to be biased because Chris and I have the Certified Financial Planner designation, but we went through a hell of a lot more study to get our CFP designations than anyone ever does for the Series 65.
Yeah, and the good point, there is a very big difference between a financial planner and a certified financial planner. As soon as that certified gets put back on there, that's a title that is given by the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, and you have to essentially pass a lot of hurdles in order to receive that designation, to include formal education on a huge list of topics in all areas of financial planning. You've then got to pass an exam, a pretty strenuous exam, I might say, that strenuous exam used to be 3 parts over 2 days. It's now been shortened to, I believe, 2 parts in 1 day. But it's you feel like you've been through some type of athletic event when you're finished. It's so draining. And then you also have to have, before you can receive the full designation, you must have professional experience in the area of financial planning. That I believe, and I should know this right off the top of my head, I believe it's 3 years. There are some differences depending. There's some other things you can do to earn that, so I'm not going to go into those details. But that's significant to get that versus, oh, I'm just going to call myself a financial planner. I don't have to do anything if I'm going to give financial planning advice on anything except investments. As long as I stay away from that and just give people all kinds of other life financial advice, I don't have to do any kind of licensing. If I want to give investment advice, then I have to at least get my Series 65. And then there's other regulatory and licenses that you can get to do different types of things that might be a little more advanced and expose people to more financial risk than a basic Series 65 would give you the ability to do. But it's a very low hurdle. You're absolutely right. And when you compare it to cutting hair, for instance, I'm still to this day shocked there's such a difference. But
well, hair is from... we often talk about Michael Kitsis on the show. Am I pronouncing that right? Kitsis? Or is it Kitsis?
No, it's Kitsis. Kitsis.
Kitsis. All right. Any industry person listening right now, you should know who Michael Kitsis is. If you don't, Google his name. Go to his website, Nerd's Eye View. That's his blog, Nerd's Eye View. And he just has a wealth of information for financial planners. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, I would actually join Nerd's Eye View and learn from Michael. He teaches an awful lot. But
a lot of his stuff, if those of you who really want to go deep into he gets really deep into
you
some
think
stuff.
I go deep?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. He goes fathoms below me. So this is from his website. He's the one who got me thinking of this recently because he was saying how the long and the short of it is it's ridiculous what you have to do just to be a financial planner. It's nothing. He puts, the Series 65 exam itself is a 130 questions that are scored plus 10 additional questions they use to seed future exams. So you will have 140 questions, but 10 don't count.
They're just test questions.
Test questions. Mm-hmm. Okay. He says a passing grade is just 72%.
Right.
It's a straight pass-fail. There is no bonus or attention given to scoring a 90 versus a 73. It's a PF. Yep. So you can be very smart or very dumb. Kitsis says it's only a 3-hour exam. I thought it was a 4-hour exam. It's a 3-hour exam, 130 questions, technically 140, but 10 questions are seed questions for future exams. He feels the average person will take 10 to 20 hours to study and prep for the exam. Did you hear that, people? This is an industry talking head, not me. 10 to 20 hours, and then you take a 130-question, 3-hour exam.
Get a 73, and you're good to go.
Or 72. 72
true,
or
even
higher.
72 will get you. 72 will get you right away.
And now you can take $500,000 from someone and tell them what to do with their money and never have to take another exam for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. That's my industry, folks. Welcome to it. So what I want you to understand, and again, I'm trying to find on his website, and I will find it, how many questions are tied to the actual law and don't even ask actual financial or investment management questions. How many pertain to the law of 1940? I will get to that next minute that Chris starts talking. But what I want our listeners to know, when you interview a financial planner, I would ask them point blank, how did you get here today? Tell me a little bit about yourself. How are you here? And if the best thing they can say is, well, I didn't have any calling in life until I took the Series 65 exam, and now I just love financial planning. If that's their answer, I would find a new financial planner.
I would also be, while longevity can mean good things, just because someone's been doing it for a long time doesn't necessarily mean they're good. I have seen on a number of occasions people that have been in the business for 10, 15 plus years, and I'm shocked at the type of advice that they give in this day and age. Either their advice is very dated, and because they have no ongoing continuing education requirements, they're not staying up to date with the laws and techniques and things that we know about how the markets work and how retirement usually plays out for people and their needs. But it's up to you. Unfortunately, the regulators aren't doing it for you. It's up to you to do your own due diligence and find someone who you're comfortable with, that you have been convinced has the information that you need and has advice that you can trust.
Okay, I like that. I'm still trying to find the breakdown, but I'll find it before the end of the show.
Let's hit our first email then.
Okay, so we're done with this tangent?
I think so.
I guess the takeaway, folks, and we got on this by talking about the financial entertainers, we call them. A lot of financial advisors, there is no measure whether the CFP designation is the best or not. I don't know. You can have some. I've met some very good non-CFPs, Chris.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Who are really good advisors because they've taken the extra step and gone out and they study. They go to industry events. They learn. They read. They write. They actually write articles. Mm-hmm. And they might not have any designations.
Most of the people that are good in this industry have gone through most of the steps that are required to be a CFP, even if they haven't actually gotten it. So, if someone is really enthusiastic and driven in this particular and wants to learn all they can so they can give the best advice that they possibly can, they can do all that. They absolutely could be a great advisor, great financial planner with basic regulatory authority. And so it's not, again, it's not a guarantee you're going to get great advice if they're a CFP. While it is one good filter, I think, because they did have to at least go through the whole process, prove that they knew the information on a very strict test. They had to take the formal education. So chances are you're going to get at least a decent situation. The truly excellent ones is really going to come from personal drive, someone who's taken on their own initiative to learn even far more than is taught within the CFP program and become an expert in their particular field.
Yeah, and that's what Kitsis's article here is saying. He really feels people need to do far more than just pass the Series 65, and that is the truth. You have to be careful with advisors, so interview them. Find out about their education. All this will be on ADV Form 2. Ask them for it. Look at it. Look at that form. They have to give it to you, their ADV 2. That's going to have all their education, Chris, that they went to. See what their schooling is. then see what type of industry designations they have. You have to be careful because there's a lot of industry designations you can go out and buy. The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, otherwise known as FINRA, or as we call them, Darth Vader. That's a joke, Mr. FINRA people, if you're listening. But they have warnings out to investors that a lot of acronyms after advisors' names are meaningless. They go to weekend courses in sunny Hawaii somewhere, or Florida, or anywhere. It can be in the bowels of Minnesota. And they just go away for a weekend course and take a little exam at the end of the weekend, and they have a three-letter or four-letter acronym after their name, and it makes them look impressive. So you have to watch out for that. There's a whole cottage industry that has cropped up, and this is coming from the Securities Exchange Commission and FINRA warning people on this. But I suggest you go there and you talk to your advisors or advisors that you're interviewing. Find out where they went to study. Ask them, what do you do to maintain your education? What groups do you belong to? What symposiums do you normally go to? Of course, there's no way of proofing all this, but if the guy and gal is umming and awing and can't answer it straight. But I would also ask them questions. You listen to my show. We've taught people on this show a lot of the small ins and outs that a lot of people don't know. Start writing those down and then asking them and see if they really know their stuff. I mean, it's the only way you can do it, because there is no uniform education requirements. There's no minimum knowledge requirements, experience requirements, continuing education, nothing. It's really the wild, wild west out there. And the regulators got their head up their hiney, making sure we understand a law that was written, my God, 77 years ago. And we're supposed to know every single nuance of that law, as if that law is going to solve anything. We've said this before. Who passed the Series 65 and became an RIA and stole more money than anyone?
Bernie
Madoff.
The big Bernie.
I mean, Bernie Madoff was an RIA, a registered investment advisor. And if he became the RIA, he didn't even have to do the Series 65.
But he was held to a fiduciary standard, which is supposed to be the holy grail of making your advisor watch out for you, because they're supposed to put your needs and your situation ahead of any of their own concerns. So they shouldn't put commissions they may earn or other kickbacks they might get, anything like that, ahead of the advice. They should always be looking out and doing things in your best interest. That's the fiduciary standard. And he had signed up to do that. He had promised to do that, and instead stole money from practically everybody he ever engaged with.
Okay, so anyway, we've talked about this. It gets me frustrated. And then we're going to get an email, because we always do. Well, we're going to get a caller to the live show. How do I vet my planner? Notice I can't give a straight answer on that. There is no way, folks. Go with your gut. Go with your intuition. Don't be swayed by a fancy-dancy office, because that's just the cream on top. That's just the BS sprinkling of what do you call that little glitter stuff? Glitter. That's just glitter on top of
who knows what.
Poop.
Yeah.
It just looks good. Wow, that's shiny. Don't touch it. It's just glitter on top of that. You got to dig deep. Go with your intuition. Try to learn a little bit about them. Google their name. See where they have been quoted, if anywhere. See if they've written anything. See if they contribute somehow. Just do a little due diligence. Ask them tough questions. But there is no minimum measure to be in my industry. And it's frustrating, not for me. My business is successful. I'm going to do well. I am doing well. I love what I do. I think listeners can sense that. You know that. Mm-hmm. You love what you do. And we really enjoy this. We're not saying this out of sour grapes, as if somehow telling listeners in Northern Colorado and on iTunes, be careful who you hire, is going to help us. I get frustrated on this for the listeners. You don't know how many times people come in here or call the show or listen to Ramsey as we go. That's how we got on this topic, Dave Ramsey's bad advice to that South Carolina listener in December. The advice that's being given out there at some points in time, Chris, is so bad. It frustrates me because I see the pain it's caused people. And people don't know any better because they think the regulators are out there protecting them. The regulators have their heads up their hineys on this. Not the regulators. Their hands are tied. They have to operate within the realm of the law. Congress has their heads up their you-know-what on this because they haven't identified that financial planning is different than investment advising, and maybe they should start passing minimum standards for you to start giving this advice. The regulators are only acting within the confines of the one law that authorizes them, the 1940 Act. So I can't blame the regulators, but maybe they could say to Congress someday, hey, you guys got to give us some more leeway here. Maybe the regulators got to speak up. I don't know. It frustrates the hell out of me because I deal with this day in and day out when I see bad advice being given. And it's just horrendous. Okay, let's go to email number one.
Perfect.
Okay, email number one came in December 29th, so we got to this promptly in 3 weeks. One thing, I say this all the time. We encourage our iTunians to reach out to us. Absolutely. You can call and schedule a coffee and a second opinion, or you can go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Schedule a coffee and a second opinion phone call, or just send us an email. It's your choice. If you do a phone call, we can, you know, talk a little live. Email, we're a little slower on that. When you send an email, please do not expect a reply right away. We are actual, real, practicing financial planners. And Chris also, he likes to think he's busy because he has a full-time job at CSU, a wife and six kids. But he really has a lot of free time, don't you?
Oh, yeah. It's oodles.
Hey, I got the tough life. I got to go home and take care of my dog. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It is. You got to go outside and walk around a good 5 minutes with him or he barks at the door.
Frustrating.
It is. So I know what it's like to be busy.
I appreciate that. Appreciate the empathy.
But all jokes aside, even though I do have a dog, a very busy dog at home, I can't get to emails right away. So this one was sent on December 29th, and now we're getting to it, mostly because I print them and put them on this desk here, and then I lose them under all other emails. So she begins, Dear Jim and Chris, I hate to even mention this. And then I went, oops, because I always fear that someone's going to point out you said something wrong.
Oh, and that sometimes happens.
But it begins, Dear Jim and Chris, I hate to even mention this because I think it will get your blood boiling. Uh-oh. And when I read this, it did. I'm kind of like, what the? But anyways, so Dear Jim and Chris, I hate to even mention this because I think it will get your blood boiling. But just before I heard your most recent show on beneficiary designations, if you remember, we did that about 3-4 weeks ago, we had a meeting with our estate planning attorney. I have her notes right here in front of me, and it says...
I can see exactly where this car wreck is going.
You know where it's going?
Yep.
Where do you think it's going?
Name the estate.
Exactly.
The beneficiary.
So this woman continues to write, I have her notes right here in front of me, and it says that one of the benefits for using your estate as beneficiary of your IRA, ready for this, Chris, is that the executor can, and she now uses quotes, because so I'm assuming this is coming direct from the attorney notes, quote, mix and match who gets what. So the humans can get the retirement accounts and charities will get the IRA, close quotes.
Wow.
Then it says we have reciprocal wills. This is the writer. I'm not sure if it's a man or a woman. We have reciprocal wills, but if both of us were to die fairly close together, we want to split between family members and charity. We have both taxable and tax-deferred accounts. What do you think? Thanks so much for the show. I've grown to enjoy your banter. And please say Chris isn't leaving the podcast. I almost fell out of my chair when he said that on the last show. So there's another fan you have.
I guess I tricked a lot of people. I guess I sounded a little too serious.
Chris is not leaving the show.
Not quite yet.
Georgette. We'll call her Georgette.
It's in February.
She's from California. We already have a star on California. When we come back from the break, I'm going to address some of the things in this email because I just think that is some of the most horrendous advice, mm-hmm. once again, someone is getting.
Perfect. So when we come back from this short break, we're going to hear the top song from this week in 1977 as we look back 40 years. This week's hit song from 77 is the debut song from a group that started as a recording and touring unit to back up the Temptations. So they were the backups to the Temptations. We'll find out who that is after this short break.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-055.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. I didn't realize this song had quite such a long intro. Now it finally sounds like the song. So I'll let that play in the background. Welcome back to the show. This is the number one song from 1977, this week in 77.
And they were backups to the... Someone, who were they backing up?
The Temptations. So this, of course, is Car Wash, performed by the band Rose Royce. Not Rolls, Rose, R-O-S-E, Royce. This song was the theme song for the 1976 film of the same name. And, whoa, what the heck? Norman Whitfield wrote this, and when he came up with the song, he needed to get it written down as fast as he could. He used the only paper he could quick access to, a paper bag from a local fast food eatery. Must have been in his car or something. Interesting. Sold over 2 million copies. Song that was written down on a fast food paper bag.
And it became a movie.
I don't know which came first. It was used as the movie. And
it was used as a song in
the
movie.
I don't know if the
wash.
Song was created for the movie, like the movie was the idea, and then they came up with the song. That I don't know.
Oh.
Nor am I going to look that up, because that one I wouldn't care about.
Okay.
To be honest with you. Although, I will say, at the top of the show, I forgot one, probably the most important thing that we were going to cover on this show, and that was to sample this fine Kringle that one of our sent to us.
We are leading into that.
So maybe you can describe how we got on the subject of Kringles, which is a Danish pastry.
What I want to do, yes, I want to, before we jump into the email question, we have to answer the question yet for a listener, we want to give a special shout out to a listener who... again, remember this emailer signed it Georgette, so I'm assuming it is a female. Mm-hmm. And this listener signed his, I guess you could say, gift to us as Bluegrass George. And mm-hmm. we always call anyone who emails us to protect their privacy, we call them George.
Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
And so over Christmas.
And we did, just before Christmas, I mentioned, and I brought a bottle just to show you. There's, that's the bottle hitting our table. I mentioned to you because I know you like having Bailey's in hot coffee. Mm-hmm. And I told you recently when I was at the liquor store, and I went to the liquor store today to buy it because that store is closing. You know the Safeway over here that they're going to rip down and put mm-hmm. condos in.
Right.
So that's the only liquor store I have seen this in. So I went and bought another bottle today.
Mm. And he bought Kringle Cream.
Kringle Cream.
And there's actually, look at that. I didn't notice there's a picture of a Kringle.
I didn't know what that was.
Right
now
on there.
I know. Because yeah. Chris and I had mentioned to Chris that I got this new, that's not liqueur. What would it be called? It's just this new cream liqueur.
It's gluten-free, nut-free. It's rum. There's rum
yes,
in
Yes, rum.
There.
Yeah.
It's rum with Wisconsin dairy cream and natural Kringle flavor.
Right. And it's called Kringle Cream, and it's from Wisconsin, a distillery, mm-hmm. Nordic Distillers in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It is phenomenal in hot coffee mm-hmm. on a cold winter's
I'll
night.
Bet.
So I've only found this in one liquor store in Fort Collins, Colorado so far. There's probably others, I'm sure. I don't go to every liquor store. But the one near the office carried it. And then I read that they're closing. And there's mm-hmm. a big sign in the Safeway store. Everything is being liquidated to go in, and they've got it like 10 or 20% off on stuff. So I went next door to the liquor store, mm-hmm. and there's no sale there. But I went in and bought another bottle of Kringle Cream. And it's a good thing I did, because a listener heard that same show. Mm-hmm. And the listener lives in Kentucky, calls himself Bluegrass George. To protect his privacy. We know his real name, but he does call himself Bluegrass George. And apparently we've answered a question or two for him over mm-hmm. the years. And he felt bad when you and I were totally clueless on what a Kringle was. Mm-hmm. I thought this was named because it was for Christmas, like Kringle Cream mm-hmm. was going to taste pepperminty yeah. and stuff.
No.
It doesn't. And if you actually read the back of the Kringle Cream, it says originating from the Old Norse word kringla, meaning ring or circle. The kringle is a hand-rolled Danish pastry that has been rested overnight before being shaped into an oval, filled with fruit, nuts, and spices, baked, and topped with a sweet icing. And then it says Kringle Cream continues this Wisconsin tradition, combining natural Kringle flavor with real Wisconsin cream. That's on the bottle of Kringle Cream. Well, he sent us a Kringle. It came in the mail yesterday.
An actual Kringle.
A real
Danish.
Kringle.
Mm-hmm. From the...
Wisconsin.
From the capital of Kringles, Racine, Wisconsin specifically. That's
exactly.
where all... There's several places that all they do is make these Kringles and crank them out in huge quantities.
So anybody out there who's never had a Kringle, first of all, look for Kringle Cream next to the Bailey's in your liquor store and get it. And on a cold winter's night, mix that with your hot coffee and it's good.
It's probably good in hot cocoa as well.
I didn't try it in hot cocoa.
But coffee.
But mm-hmm. we also now know that there is a bakery. This thing came next day here, or second day mm-hmm. here, so it's got to be fresh. It's right here. We have never had a Kringle. We opened the box. It is oval. Mm-hmm. I had no idea it was stuffed with things. It is stuffed with things. Mm-hmm. And we want to thank Bluegrass
like,
George. Mm-hmm. And he is from Kentucky, yet he knew about Wisconsin Kringles.
Well, maybe that's where he grew up or something.
It is possible. He also has extended a trip to Kentucky. Because you're making fun of me when I mention that Kentucky is on my short list of potential.
This Kringle is glorious.
You're not letting me talk.
I don't care now. This is good.
You've had a piece. Is it really that good?
It's quite good.
Okay. Well, Chris has tried a piece of Kringle. I am going to try a piece of
Kringle.
So
while he tries this, I'll summarize the... So thank you, Bluegrass George. We're going to greatly enjoy this.
Oh, my Lord. This has everything in it my doctor doesn't want me to eat.
Good.
This is really good.
Yeah, it is good. So before the last break, we had Jim had read an email. Someone who had listened to a show where we talked about beneficiary designation forms, which are a way to direct the proceeds from certain types of accounts so that you can direct who they go to upon your passing when you die. And
can I interrupt you for 1 minute?
Sure.
I just have to say Bluegrass George.
Mm-hmm. One You've of our just, favorite listeners now.
He has just ruined. My doctor wants me to lose 4 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't eat the whole Kringle. Just
I'm not going to lose 4 pounds with this Kringle in the office.
Mm-hmm. Your doctor is so persnickety that he's talking about 4 pounds?
No, he just mentioned to me at my last physical in November, gee, Mr. Song, he calls me Jim, Jim, you did gain 4 pounds since our last visit. And then he looks at you with that condescending look and he starts writing in your file and you don't even know what he's writing, but he makes you feel guilty.
For me, 4 pounds is like a rounding error.
I know. For you, it's a rounding error. For me, it was something major. So now he got to me. And my goal is next year for him to say I've lost that 4 pounds.
Mm. Well, you better stay away from the Kringle.
With this Kringle, that is not going to happen.
No.
Okay, thank you, Bluegrass George, for this wonderful Kringle. So go ahead.
So anyway, the email was asking about beneficiary designation forms. And the listener had heard us discuss those and the pros and cons of using them and who you should name on there and who can be the primary and secondary and how that might work and what are the advantages of using one and all kind. We spent an entire show, and we have several shows actually in the archives about these forms that are so important, particularly for your retirement accounts and other accounts that might have these, because it allows you to bypass probate, avoid other issues that might come up because of that process, etc. So she heard us talk about this and then had just recently discussed with her own estate planning attorney how they should fill out the beneficiary designation forms for their retirement accounts, their IRAs, and maybe she doesn't go into the list, but maybe 401ks and other retirement accounts she might have. And the attorney advised what we mocked essentially because of the less than optimal nature of this approach, naming the estate itself as the beneficiary on the beneficiary designation form. And our advice has always been that that is almost never the optimal way to go, the best way to go, and exposes you to all kinds of possible bad things happening. And the main possibility is those assets aren't going to end up going where you want them to go, or exposing them to taxes or other penalties that you could otherwise avoid. Does that summarize it pretty well?
It does. And in this question, or the email question that came to us, I'm a little confused on it. So if this listener is listening, Georgette from California, she calls herself, I would have a few questions, and I'm going to reach out to her to tell her to listen to the show for the answer. But she,
just the second half, because the first half we kind of went off on the tangent.
That's all right. Okay. People expect that. Mm-hmm. We gave them advice and information. Mm-hmm. Wasn't that we were just talking about this scrumptious Kringle. You had better eat that.
Oh, I'll be eating some more.
Yeah, I'm sure you're going to eat that whole one in there. Tina already had a piece from upstairs, but Justin hasn't yet, and neither has Andrew.
They don't need to try it.
Well, are you kidding? They're 32 and they're bone thin. They can eat that. It's me and Tina that have to watch what we're doing. But, okay. So what concerned or confused me is she said, and she put this in quotation marks, so I'm guessing this is direct from the notes. She said this is from her attorney notes. Mm-hmm. Quote, mix and match who gets what so that the humans get the retirement accounts and the charities get the IRAs. End quote. The listener said that is what she has written on why the attorney recommends she names the estate as beneficiary on all her accounts, not name the charities or the humans directly on the beneficiary form, but leave everything to the estate and let the executor, quote unquote, mix and match. Mm-hmm. That has got to be some of the worst advice I have ever heard. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that, listener. You got to trust me on this. If you name a retirement account to the estate and not directly to charity, it gets paid to the estate first. Mm-hmm. It's going to now be subject to probate. Whether or not that's a big issue, I don't know. Well, it's California, so it is a big issue. California probate is outrageously expensive and complicated, from what I've been told. I don't know. We're not in California. But not only that, you're going to expose it to taxes. Mm-hmm. And if you give it just to the charities directly, there is no taxes.
No taxes, no probate issues.
No probate, no taxes. Charities will inherit the IRA. They can sell it the very next day and pay no taxes. You leave it to the estate as the named beneficiary. Not that you named a human, the human had died, and it ended up going to the estate. But you are naming the estate as beneficiary. So there's no ambiguity there. So there's no going to the summary plan description in the case of a 401k or the custodial agreement in the case of an IRA and saying, gee, who do I name if there's no beneficiary? Who gets this? There is a beneficiary. The estate. You named it. So now the estate gets this IRA and has certain distribution rules they have to follow. Now, true, they could take a distribution from the IRA and then make a donation to the charity. But now you have to leave the estate open. You have to file an estate income tax. The estate may or may not be able to deduct the entire contribution. And it just becomes a nightmare.
It's a mess.
It's a mess. Absolute mess. But the other thing that confused me on this is she said, so the humans get the retirement accounts and the charities get the IRAs. That confuses me.
Well, if it was as simple as that, you would just name the charity as the beneficiary of the IRAs and they would get it, and name the humans the beneficiary of the other retirement accounts, 401ks, etc. So why it would be named to the estate to split that, I'm not sure. I would guess she alludes to the fact or makes the comment that the executor of the estate could then decide where it goes.
Right.
So true.
Because she does put here, she's worried that if her and her husband die, quote unquote, fairly close together, we want to split equally between family members and charities. So I think what she was trying to do and what the attorney is trying to say is, look, just leave everything to the estate and then let the executor say, okay, here's what's left. Mm-hmm. We want it to go equally between the humans and the charities, and that's the easiest way to do it, the attorney is saying. I'm not disputing that that might be easy if everything just gets paid out and they spread it that way, but you're going to lose so much of the tax benefits, and that's going to be more of the problem. So to me, just give to the charity what you want to give and name it directly as beneficiary of the retirement accounts. The non-retirement accounts are what should go to humans, not the retirement accounts. And maybe
Say she has any, but maybe that's
well,
what she meant.
Said she wants the humans to get the retirement accounts. I'm wondering if she meant the humans to get the non-retirement accounts. And that the attorney probably would have told her. Because charities can inherit your retirement accounts, 401k, 457, IRAs, TSPs, things like that. They can inherit retirement accounts 100% income tax free. Humans cannot. Humans will always have to pay taxes on those. But when a human inherits a non-retirement account, they can receive those tax-free because of a portion of the or an element in the tax code called step-up in basis. Meaning if you pay $100,000 for something and die and it's now worth $500,000, if you sell it while you're alive, you have to pay taxes on that $400,000 gain. Not income taxes, but capital gains taxes. However, if you pay $100,000 for something, die when it's worth $500,000 and leave it to a human, that human could sell that item for $500,000, Chris, and owe zero in income and capital gains taxes because the item on the date of death steps up to the value on the date of death. Mm-hmm. And a human beneficiary only owes taxes if it was sold for more than what it was worth on the date of death. So humans can really inherit things tax-free. Whereas if a human inherited an IRA worth $500,000, they have to pay taxes on that $500,000. So it's always best to leave retirement assets or IRA assets to charities, and humans will get non-IRA assets. But if you're really wanting to make sure things are equal, I want my humans to get this much and I want charities to get this much. It's going to get a little more difficult because of retirement accounts.
It's a little more creative, they'll have to be. So naming the estate was the simplistic way of accomplishing what I think they want to accomplish, the flexibility of being able to split what's left 50-50. The cost of doing it, though, the cost of this simplicity is way too high. There's just so many negatives that come along with naming the estate that being a little more creative on maybe splitting the IRAs.
They just need a trust. They just need to create a trust. That's all they have to
Absolutely.
Do. You could create a trust to receive all the assets. And inside that trust, the trust can start splitting up who gets what. Mm-hmm. And then the trust can pay out the non-spouse beneficiaries, non-human beneficiaries or charities directly before what is called the designation date, September 30th, now of the year following the owner's death. But if you don't want to deal with the expense of a trust, you could just do a little bit. It's going to, you know, every year update the beneficiary forms to react to the change in value of your accounts and make sure the charities continue to inherit about a third or whatever. I'm making this up, a third. I'm assuming there's two other children.
Whatever
the percent you want to go to charities. Mm-hmm. But name the charities directly on the retirement accounts, the 401ks, the IRAs, the 403bs. Just name the charities directly. And then probably every year is even too much, listener. Mm-hmm. Maybe every 3, 4, 5 years, look at your total assets again and say, oh, wow, everything has grown. I don't want the charities getting a third of it. I want them getting 28% of it now. That's the breakdown. So then you just do another beneficiary designation form with 28% mentioned. What you can't do, or what they're trying to do, is leave everything to the estate and then let the executor divide it all up equally and say, this is going to the charities, this is going to humans. The estate now is going to have to receive all this money from the IRA. They're going to have these different type of distribution rules that I don't want to bore everyone with, but they're going to have to get that money out of the IRAs, and the estate is going to be subject to paying the taxes on any of the IRA that ends up going to humans, because they're just saying throw it all into this big pool and let the executor split it. Well, I don't know how much assets she has, but let's say most of the money is in an IRA. Now it's all getting paid to the estate. Now the estate has to pass all that on to humans. And now you have a situation where the estate has received this money. And now the ability of the humans to either delay the required distributions over their lifetime or disclaim the inheritances if they wanted to, or other types of planning, is all lost. Mm-hmm. And now the estate is going to be faced with some massive income taxes on the items that are going to the humans, because the IRA is going to have to be paid out in full within 5 years of the IRA owner's death, or if the IRA owner died after their required beginning date. This is why it gets confusing, folks, which is April 1st of the year following the year they turn 70 and a half. If the IRA owner dies after that date, the estate doesn't have to use the 5-year rule. They can use the remaining life expectancy of the IRA owner on how fast that money has to come out. But the estate has to stay open.
I was going to say, you got to keep the estate open that whole time then.
During that whole time. Whereas if you just name on the beneficiary form, right there, let's just look at it this way, listener. Let's just say you have two children and an estate, and she wants to make sure a third goes to everyone. A third goes to child one, a third goes to child two, and a third goes to charity. Why is she doing it this way? On the beneficiary form, just put child one, 33.3%. Child two, 33.33%. Estate, 33.34%. There's always one extra tenth of a percent that goes to someone. That's all you do, a third, a third, a third. And just leave it that way, Chris. Mm-hmm. That would assume, because she said in here, she wants to make sure the humans and the charities get equal amounts. That just solved her problem. And now it will go without any taxes, any probate, no delay, not subject to creditors, not subject to bankruptcy. It'll go right to the charity and right to the humans.
Well, let me fix something you said, though. The 33.34 needs to go directly to the charity, not to the estate. In order to do that. Otherwise, you're
going to... Oh, did I say to the estate?
You said to the estate.
Oh, no, no, no. You have that little thing. I mean, you should have pressed that. That one, yeah. No, no. I'm just all riled up. Mm-hmm. Definitely, it should go to the charity. But I'll go one step further. Let's just say, listen, you have two accounts of equal value, an IRA and a non-IRA. I would give most of the IRA to the estate. Excuse me. To the charities. The non-IRAs give to humans. Humans will inherit non-retirement accounts without any income tax liability. They get a step up in basis. Charities can inherit an IRA, which will always be subject to income taxes to a human. The charities can inherit it 100%. Tax-free. So if you do some good beneficiary planning, you can really reduce the amount of taxes the government gets just by paying attention. Okay.
Perfect.
I'm going to go back.
So I'm glad she listened because it sounds like she hit a show that directly pertained to her,
what she was
situation
doing. So I'm
and
hoping
raised
she,
a question.
If she still did this, I'm recommending you change. Mm-hmm. Go back to the attorney or find someone to talk to or call us for a coffee and a second opinion. We do meet with people from out the United States. Just don't name the estate as beneficiary. It's going to be a tax nightmare to your executor.
Perfect. So after this short break, we'll be in our last segment. And when we come back, we're going to hear the number one song from this week in 1982. Replacing Olivia Newton-John this week at number one is a song from a popular male duo. And it's good. Olivia Newton had, John had 10 weeks or so.
I know who it is.
It's time
for
someone else.
The Kiss is on my list group. What is that?
We'll see.
Hall & Oates. And in the meantime.
That's your guess?
That's my guess is Hall & Oates.
Okay.
I'm going to go back and eat some more Kringle.
Perfect. We'll be back momentarily.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Those are our good friends, Daryl Hall and John Oates. They're not really our friends, but they seem like a friendly couple. The guys from the 1980s. Anyway, that is I Can't Go For That by Hall & Oates. Written by them and a frequent writing partner, Sarah Allen. Says many listeners assume this song is about a relationship, but Hall & Oates meant it to apply to the record industry itself. This was a common theme they have used in many of their songs. Due to heavy playing on urban stations, this song also hit number one on the R&B list, which was unexpected by the duo. It was their fourth number one hit and second hit from their Private Eyes album. So Hall & Oates for you there. So we play these songs. Just for those of you maybe tuning in for the first or second time, aren't sure what's going on with the music, we play these songs as a connection to our discussions on Social Security. The song from 1935 ties into the fact that Social Security started in 1935. Then we look back 40 years ago and 35 years ago to connect with a couple of the ways that Social Security benefits are calculated, the first one being the what's referred to as 40 elapsed years, which was the assumed standard career length. And then the 35 computational years, which is probably the most impactful for people because it's the recognizes the fact that your 35 highest indexed annual earnings years are used in the calculation of your retirement benefit. So it's those 35 years. If you have less than 35 years, there's going to be some zeros in your calculation. If you've got more than 35, they just pick the best 35 after adjusting for inflation. So that all ties into our updates that we do every week on what's new on our blog, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
So this week on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, our paper statements are going away again. So those of you been working for a while know that for the longest time you used to get a paper statement every year around your birthday that had your updated prediction for what your retirement benefit would be from Social Security based on your earnings record and some assumptions for what your earnings would be from that day until you retired. And we would get those regularly every single year. They would show up in the mail. Then back in 2011, they suspended that. They stopped mailing them as a cost-saving measure and introduced an online portal that they expected people to sign up for and get that information electronically. Well, very few people did that. And by the end of 2012, there was such a little uptake, so little traction on people doing that, they decided to bring back the printed statements, but on a less frequent basis. They brought those back to be every 5 years at your age 25, 30, 35, etc. But they still wanted people to do the online version. Well, they obviously think that enough people are doing it because they've suspended completely the paper statements again for everyone under the age of 60. So now, as we know it, if you are under the age of 60, you will not see one of these paper statements. You'll have to get the information online. And after you're 60, the only way you're going to get a paper statement is if you haven't signed up online. If you're online, you're never going to see one. They shut you off completely and they make you rely on the online portal. If you refuse to sign up, you will start to get statements at age 60 because they assume you want to know the situation as you approach your retirement age. So that's a...
And when did they pass this?
This just happened here in January. So I don't think I have the exact date, but this is a brand new development. Just got released on the Social Security website. They made this announcement earlier this month.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
What's new, pussycat?
Okay. All righty. Well, we have
Did you enjoy your Kringle? Your extra Kringle at the break?
Yeah, I have...
How much is left out there?
Kentucky Bluegrass George. Well, rumor is spreading throughout the office now that that Kringle is damn good.
Mm-hmm. So it's shrinking as we're
shrinking.
In here?
It's shrinking. It is shrinking, which is a good thing. Because I have 4 pounds to lose.
Not today. There's
not
always
with that
tomorrow.
Kringle. But I have a friend who grew up in Wisconsin. Lisa, mm-hmm. You know Lisa. And
yeah,
I'm going to have to ask Blondie, which you've never told me about Kringles.
She probably can make one. It's probably required learning in the grade schools there or something.
But I'm going to usually go out to lunch once a week, so I'm going to ask her if she knows. I want to know what the filling is. It's just really good.
It's nuts, and I think it's kind of brownish, so I'm guessing there's maybe some dates or something blended up in there and some sugar and some spices. But there's nuts in there. They're just kind of... blended up, kind of tastes a little walnut-y.
It's just an oasis of mm-hmm. everything my doctor doesn't want me eating.
Nuts are healthy.
Not baked into all that fat and sugar
the,
and cream.
The pastry, I'm sure, has tons of butter in it. Because
I'm sure
that,
I shouldn't be drinking Kringle cream either in my quest to lose 4 pounds.
It's okay as long as you drink it straight. Leave that nasty coffee out of there.
It's the nasty coffee that makes it nice and warm.
True.
But, yeah, I'm just curious on how much of that is calories and how much of that Kringle cream liqueur is actually good for me.
Not much is good in that bottle. But
it tastes good. Mm-hmm. But in a hot coffee, try that instead of Bailey's.
Next time,
listeners, you're in the liquor store, and you're in the Bailey's section for that Bailey's Irish
Kringle cream with a K.
Look for the Kringle Cream with a K. It's in the same aisle. It's right next to the Bailey's Irish Cream Liqueur. But I have not seen that at every liquor store. So, and I don't know where this liquor store is going to move to, the one that has to vacate for the condos.
I don't know.
Okay, so we have a question from a listener in New Jersey. And it is a follow-up to one of his questions that we answered. So he sent a follow-up. I will answer this quickly. It's not going to take me too long to answer. You could probably answer it as well. But
thanks.
What? That's a compliment.
You made it sound like it's so easy, even I could answer it.
You could. It's that easy.
Okay. Thanks.
Are you smarter than a fifth grader?
Some days.
This came in January 18th, so we're not too far behind on this one. Okay. It begins, "Hi, Jim. I listened to your latest episode and heard your answers to my questions." You'll probably remember this gentleman as I go on with the email, Chris. "Since there is a rule that says when someone quits his job after he turns 55, he should be able to get money out of his 401k without having to pay the early withdrawal penalty, even though he is younger than 59 and a half." I'm going to stop there. It is not after he turns 55, as this gentleman wrote. Please understand, listener, as long and all our listeners, as long as you retire in the year you are going to turn 55.
Or later.
Or later. You can withdraw money from that employer's 401k and that 401k only without paying the early withdrawal penalty. The early withdrawal penalty says you will pay 10% of the withdrawal to the government in the form of a penalty tax, not an income tax, a penalty tax if you take money out of a retirement account before the age of 59 and a half. So you could actually be 54 and not exposed to this. How? I was born July 24th. What if I retire, if I work for a company, I work for myself, but what if I worked for a company and I retired January 2nd in the year I turned 55?
You'll be 54 for a good 7 months.
Yeah, I'm barely 54 as it is. I am now 54, but I am retiring in the year I turn 55. I can start withdrawing money from that 401k without paying a 10% early withdrawal penalty. So you could be as young as 54, and this is can happen. It all depends on where your birthday falls. So I wanted to fix that part, or at least address that part.
That's
in
good
his
news. It's better than he described.
Correct. Okay. So he writes, "I would think that I can get money out from either my traditional 401k or my Roth 401k without having to pay the early withdrawal penalty." Yes, that answer is true. "I understand that you said if I tried to get money from the Roth 401k without first converting it to a Roth IRA, the money would be a mixture between my contributions and the gain." Once again, that part is true. And for listeners who don't know what that means, there are very strict ordering rules when you withdraw money from a Roth IRA. The law is specific. William Roth, a Delaware senator who created Roth IRAs, he's since passed away, he was specific that the ordering rules benefit people. Not the government, because it says the first dollars to come out of a Roth IRA will always be your contributions, and your contributions can always come out at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties. So that's very, I guess, individual taxpayer friendly, not government friendly. Then he says the next dollars to come out of your Roth IRA will be conversions. Conversion money comes out. That's when you take money from an IRA and convert it to a Roth IRA. Now, you may excuse me, that money can come out, but you may end up owing a 10% penalty tax on that money. You won't owe taxes on that money because you already paid taxes on the conversion. But you may owe a 10% penalty tax on that money if you take it out before the conversion hits its fifth anniversary. So they do have that five-year rule. And then after conversions will come your growth. And the growth will be subject to taxes and a 10% penalty if you're younger than 59 and a half. Distributions from a Roth 401k don't have those ordering rules. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, short of William Roth has passed away, was not around when they made the rules for Roth 401ks, and maybe the government wanted to say, hey, it's way too beneficial to people with a Roth IRA. We're going to tilt the scale back towards our favor and make it more taxable and favorable to the government. That's the cynic in me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was that reason or another. But there are no ordering rules when you take money out. It's going to be a mixture. So this gentleman is correct. A way around that is to transfer the Roth 401k to a Roth IRA when you retire, and then poof, the ordering rules come in, mm-hmm. and you can limit it to just removing your contributions and pay no taxes or penalties on them. Mm-hmm. Okay, but then he goes on. Excuse me, goodness. Okay, so he said, would it matter because I am older than 55? Let me apologize. I'm going to have to back up a little to make sense. I'm going to begin where I left off. I understand that you said if I tried to get money from my Roth 401k account without converting it first to a Roth IRA, the money would be a mixture of contributions and gain. Yes, correct. We just answered that. But it wouldn't matter because I'm older than 55, right? I know that I could get money out of the traditional 401k without paying a penalty for sure, but I have to calculate the pre- and post-tax money. In reality, I'm probably not going to touch my Roth 401k right away, even after I retire. What he's saying is, does he really need to move it from the Roth 401k to a Roth IRA because of this age 55 exemption? And the short answer is yes, it does matter. Not for the 10% penalty, for the taxes on the growth. In order to get growth out of your Roth 401k or Roth IRA, not contributions, not conversions. Remember what we said, the last dollars to come out of a Roth IRA is the growth. Mm-hmm. And growth will always be subject to income tax, even from a Roth, unless you take what is known as a qualified withdrawal. And a qualified withdrawal has two elements. Element one, the Roth account must be at least 5 years old. Not necessarily the account you're taking the money from, but if you have at least one Roth IRA at least 5 years old, or in this case, a Roth 401k that's at least 5 years old, you have satisfied element one. But element two says one of the following four elements, hate to keep using that word, must be met. You must be either 59 and a half, mm-hmm. dead, that's not a very good mm-hmm. one, disabled, still not a very good one, or buying your first time home. And you're going to use the distribution as part of the closing costs. That's the only way to get growth out of a Roth IRA 100% tax-free. Merely because he's retiring, Chris, in the year he turns 55, it will exempt the distribution from the 10% early withdrawal penalty. Mm-hmm. It will not exempt it from taxes, even right. though it's a Roth. He has to wait until 59 and a half, not the year he's going to turn 59 and a half. He literally has right. to be one day past 59 and a half in real age. So what he's wondering is, can he take money out of the Roth IRA? Even though he's not going to have the ordering abilities of a Roth IRA, does it matter? Because I'm over the age of 55, I should be able to take it out income and penalty free. No, you'll be able to take it out penalty free, but not income tax free.
Because some of each distribution will be gain.
Right.
Because of the mixture rules, and that piece will be subject to taxation since he's under the age of 59 and a half.
Exactly. So if you have 50-50, 50% contributions, 50% growth, half of the distribution will be subject to income taxes.
Which would go away when he reaches 59 and a half, so that would be a reason not to touch during that five-year period from 55 to 59 and a half. Don't touch the Roth 401k as it is.
Right.
Either roll it out so you can get the contributions out of the Roth IRA, tax and penalty free, or leave it in there, touch the other account.
Exactly. So hopefully this makes it a little clearer to him. This is very easy, but it's very confusing. You got these different five-year rules. You have these different penalties, year of 55 or at 59 exactly and a half. I mean, you've got all these different little nuances you have to remember. But the short answer is, listener, no, your thought structure wouldn't work because you're not remembering. In order to get growth out of your Roth account 100% tax-free, you have to first make sure you have been in a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k for at least 5 years. In your case, it would be a Roth 401k. You have to make sure you've been in a Roth 401k for at least 5 years. Not the account you're taking the money from. You just need to make sure you have one Roth 401k that's at least 5 years old. The next thing, in order to get growth out tax-free, you have to be over the age of 59 and a half, dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home. And you are neither of those four. And you especially don't want to be number two or three. So you will not be able to get the growth out tax-free. If you move it to a Roth IRA, you will be able to get the contributions out tax-free, but not the growth. And you will be able to specify contributions first, Chris. So it still gives them a little bit more flexibility to get it out of the Roth 401k. But anyways, I wanted to address that because we seem to be helping this person, but also confusing him at the same time. It's a very confusing subject, and you have to make sure you know how all these little rules work.
Right, because you don't want to get bitten by taxes that you could otherwise avoid.
Exactly.
It's not that you're evading taxes. It's just the government is more than happy to collect taxes from you if you make a mistake or receive tax payments from you for which you technically may not owe the tax. They're happy to take that money in. There's no penalty for doing so. They like it. But there's no reason for you to pay taxes if you don't have to. And that's where these paying attention to these rules plays a part. And the reason why the show exists that we do here, people wonder how we could possibly talk about IRAs and retirement accounts as much as we do. And this is a prime example. What seems like people mostly talk about in the press, the real basic, simplistic things to do with an IRA. How much can you put in every year? And the fact that you should be putting money into it every year. That's talked about ad nauseum all over the place because that's the simple stuff. It's once you start moving these accounts around, consolidating the accounts, doing rollovers, doing conversions, unconverting or recharacterizing. Once you take distributions, we have all these rules and treatment of the distributions. How much is your contribution versus gain, and are they treated differently? And all of that stuff. All of that stuff you really need to know not to make mistakes.
Exactly. How much time do we have left?
We have 3 minutes.
I might be able to get to this. This listener begins. She sent this email January 12th, so mm-hmm. not too late. She signs it Georgette. Mm-hmm. I have a short question about Roth IRA conversions that may be of interest to others. Assuming an individual is 59 and a half and is planning on converting every year from a tax-sheltered account to a Roth account, should, and I want to point out to her, you don't have to be 59 and a half to convert. There's no 10% penalty on conversion. Mm-hmm. You will pay income taxes. So you could be 29 and a half, 18 and a half. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. There is no penalty on conversions. She's asking, though, should one delay a conversion till both the stock and bond markets are down, for example, in a bear market? Or does this not matter since the funds will be cheaper in price and because the market is down? You're reading way too much into conversions, listener. You don't wait for the markets to correct. If you were waiting since 09 for the markets to correct again, you've been waiting a long time because they haven't corrected since March of 09. Just convert. It doesn't matter. If you convert and stocks drop and you're thinking, oh my God, I've converted. And during this period, which is not only the year of conversion, you have until October 15th of the year after conversion. So you could have up to almost a year and 10 months to do this. If stocks drop during that year and 10-month period or your investments drop, what do, Chris?
You just recharacterize. You just unconvert. And it's as if it didn't happen. You won't be paying taxes on that larger amount. You can then turn around shortly and convert again at the lower values.
Not immediately.
Not immediately. Shortly thereafter. And there's some rules to that, but we're short on time. And so that's absolutely. Now, of course, you only have that October 15th of the year after the year you do the conversion. So there is a limited time, but it gives you a pretty large window to see if the markets go down and maybe you'd be in a better tax position.
And the other thing I want to point out, you can be giving up a lot of growth as you're waiting for a correction that could be growing tax-free.
And tax-free is way better than tax-deferred.
So to me, I recommend you get the conversion done as soon as you can. If stocks drop, you can recharacterize as long as it's done before October 15th of the year after conversion. And recharacterization, if you pay taxes, you file an amended return, you get all your tax money back. If that's not enough time, then maybe you shouldn't be converting. Don't try to time it. You'll never time it.
Right.
You'll never time it perfectly. Just convert.
Well, thanks everybody who wrote in. Please send your emails. If you go to jimhelps.com, you can find an easy way to contact us there. We'll be back next week with a brand new show for you.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.